And we are returning this morning to the Race Card Project. This is where NPR's Michelle Norris invites people to share their thoughts on race and cultural identity in just 6 words. Race is a big and complicated subject, and it's amazing how this exercise cuts straight to the heart of it. This morning, we're looking at Americans who choose to open their homes and their hearts to children who don't look like them. We're going to spend some time today looking at the intersection of race and adoption, and one aspect summed up in these 6 words. Black babies cost less to adopt. NPR's Michelle Norris joins me in the studio. Hey, Michelle.
Good to be with you, David.
So tell me about these 6 words. They were uncomfortable to say.
Yeah, and they're probably uncomfortable for people to hear. Those 6 words, black babies cost less to adopt, were an early submission to the Race Card Project a couple of years ago. They were submitted by a woman in Louisiana. She did not want to chat on the radio, but she spotlighted something that does come up again and again in the Race Card Project, the idea of the shifting fee structure in adoption that's based on the skin color of the child. And to explain this, let me introduce you to a woman in Minnesota who did want to talk on the radio, and this is what she sent in.
My name is Karen Lance, and my 6 words are navigating world as transracial adoptive family. I am the adoptive mother to a beautiful boy who is 2 years old. We adopted him at birth, and he is African-American, and my husband and I are both white.
She sounds like such a proud mom. Okay, so Karen Lance is navigating this world as part of a transracial adoptive family. Michelle, did she and her husband intend to adopt across racial lines?
She is proud. Whenever she talks about her little boys, there is a certain music to her voice. And I say boys because we just heard Karen Lance talk about her one child. Well, since we did this interview, she and her husband, Chuck, have adopted a second child, so that transracial family now includes 2 white parents and 2 black little boys. And I'm always surprised at how much candor people serve up in these stories. She said that she and her husband had tried for years, struggled for years to conceive. They decided that they were willing to adopt across race. Skin color was of no concern to them. What was a concern is once they got into the process, they discovered that there was this sliding scale that was based on skin color. Let's listen to Karen.
I distinctly remember one day having a phone call with an agency in Florida in our kitchen, and the social worker that was speaking with us was telling us about these different fee structures that they had based on the ethnic background of the child. And I remember hearing this and just sort of being dumbfounded that they would sort of segregate, to use a loaded term, segregate these children by ethnic background before they were even in this world. That's when I started realizing that, okay, being a parent to a child of a different ethnic background, this is going to be some work. There's going to be a lot of work on our end in order to be successful parents and to get our child ready for this world.
Well, Michelle, she didn't want to use the word segregate, but she did, and it's worth asking you about that. I mean, it sounds like African-American babies, people might not be as willing to adopt them. A lot of them have to wait, and so they're finding ways to move them into homes faster, but actually using a different value. What do people in the world of adoption say about that?
You know, anytime you talk about value and a child, you're in a very uncomfortable space. We talk to people in the world of adoption, agencies, people who work in government, adoptive parents. No one is comfortable about this. And they talk to us about the sliding fee scale, and they admit that it does happen. It is common. When this happens, it is often for altruistic reasons. They're trying to provide an incentive for families that might otherwise be locked out of the adoption process because it's very expensive. And they're trying to provide an incentive for families who really have to maybe have a little bit of prodding to think about adopting across racial lines. And before people pass judgment and say, you know, families aren't willing to adopt children or denying black children, you know, there's a lot that goes into that. We're told by agencies that some families actually want to do it, but they feel like they're not equipped. I had one agency tell me that they were dealing with a family that said, I would love to adopt a child of color, but I'm not sure that I can live in this neighborhood in Tennessee and bring this child home.
Well, Michelle, setting aside the motives for a second, I mean, you say that when you talk about putting a different value on something, it makes everyone uncomfortable. If that's the case, what's being done about this?
More people are starting to talk about it. And we should say that the fees that we're talking about, the costs, cover administrative costs, but also the costs associated with taking care of the mother, travel, health care, that kind of thing. And some states, some agencies are looking at a different formula for making adoption more affordable for more families. They're moving toward a sliding scale that's based on income. So lower-income families would pay less.
Well, Misha, let me return to this woman we've heard from, Karen Lance. What system did she and her husband use to adopt these children?
In the end, they adopted both their boys in a state where they used a sliding scale that was based on income instead of race.
Okay.
But when they decided to go through the adoption process, they were eager to bring a child into their home. So they also went through the home visit and the application process in agencies that did use a sliding scale based on skin color or ethnicity. And that took them out of their comfort zone.
We received 4 phone calls about potential children to be matched with us. 3 of those were in states that had this sliding fee. And one was a full African-American child, one was a biracial child, and one was a white child. And when they told me the fees for the white child, I was in a Babies R Us, and I remember having to sit down in the aisle and say to myself, I don't think we can afford to adopt this child if the expectant mother chose us.
What were the fees? What was the differential?
It was going to be around $35,000 with some legal expenses, versus when we got the first phone call about a little girl, a full African-American girl, it was about $18,000.
And there was a biracial child also, was that a
Yeah, and that
fee?
Was, in the $24,000 to $26,000 range.
Misha, listening to Karen Lance there, I keep thinking about the 6 words that she uses, navigating world as transracial adoptive family. And we've talked about navigating the world of adoption. I wonder what it's like for her and her husband as they navigate the rest of their world.
Well, there are certain challenges. They live in Minnesota, and when they go out into the community as a blended family, they get stares. And she talked to us about some of those encounters.
My son's getting to an age where I'm starting to get a little bit more concerned about those comments. You know, he's going to start to pay attention very soon. And I am a little nervous about what we're going to do when he starts to understand why someone approached us at Target and thanked us for saving babies. Or when a woman, you know, walks down the aisle of the grocery store and says, what's he mixed with? You know, I said, well, my son, we adopted him at birth. And, you know, his ethnic background is a little different, and we don't know a whole bunch about it, but he's a beautiful kid, isn't he?
That's Karen Lance and her 6 words again, navigating world as transracial adoptive family. And to find out more about her family, you can go to our website, npr.org. NPR's Michelle Norris curates the Race Card Project. And Michelle, thanks for coming in, as always.
Great to be here.
In Paris right now, the love affair between a couple in Nashville, Tennessee, and the French artwork they collected over the years is on view at the Musée d'Orsay. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg spoke with the American lenders and the French borrowers.
To say that Nashvillian Spencer Hayes is crazy for French art is an understatement.
French art just quickens our step, fires our spirit, and touches our heart.
The passion began when Mr. Hayes was 30-something. By then, he was a millionaire. Forbes estimated his worth at $400 million in 1997, rich from clothing and book-selling businesses. He and his wife did not start out that way.
When Marley and I grew up in the little town in Texas, even visiting France was far beyond our expectations. But in 1971, we made our first trip to Paris, and our love affair with this wonderful country began. We've returned every year, and our passion has grown.
I am really impressed because very rarely in my life did I see a person so much in love with French art.
Guy Cocheval, the head of the Musée d'Orsay, says you see Francophilia in the home the Hayeses built in Nashville, Tennessee.
A real palace, a French palace, copied from the Hôtel de Coinel.
A palace built in Paris in 1724. Spencer Hayes has an exact replica.
He wanted to use the limestone from Paris, and he wanted every button, every opening, every faucet to be French.
Plus all the furniture, the silverware, the Hayeses raided French antique shops, and into their Nashville palace, they put all the French art they had been collecting, much of it made in the 1890s by artists who were called the Nobbies. It means prophet. painters who moved beyond Impressionism with flat colors and Japanese composition. Two of the Nabis, Pierre Bonnard and Edouard Vuillard, were lifelong friends.
We have wonderful painting by Bonnard of Vuillard, and then Vuillard of Bonnard, and they were in their 20s when they each did that of each other.
Bonnard paints Vuillard in profile.
His beard is so red you can't believe it. The colors are so strong. And you can see the curls in his beard. And you can just tell the passion that they had for each other and for the movement.
Redheaded Vuillard paints his friend Bonnard making art. Isabel Kahn, curator of the Orsay show, says Bonnard is intent on the brush he's holding.
He doesn't look at us. He looks very carefully to his drawing or his painting. And it is a very intimate portrait.
You really see an artist at work concentrating. His eyes are focused on whatever it is he's working on.
That's true. That's true.
These are early works made in 1891, not great ones. But Orsay director Guy Courcheval says a decade later, Edouard Vuillard had developed a rather healthy ego.
In the year 1900, he's 32 years old, and he considers himself one of the greatest living artists and the savior of art.
Fans of Vuillard, the Hayeses, for example, would agree. And in this Orsay show, you can see the eye of the artist and his collectors develop as the years go by. In 1895, Vuillard made a terrific painting, which curator Isabel Kahn says involved scandal.
This scene is about infidelity of...
Infidelity?
Yes.
Really? Infidelity? It looks like a nice family scene. It's called The Table, the end of luncheon at Madame Vuillard's. Sitting around a white tablecloth, an old lady, she almost disappears into the densely flowered wallpaper, a bearded man and a young woman in a red blouse trimmed in white lace. We only see her back. Benign enough. But wait. The bearded fellow seems to be in motion.
I know a lot of men I know when they get angry at the table, they push back, and that's what he's doing.
Oh, my goodness. It seems the red and lace blouse woman is Vuillard's sister. She's married to the bearded table pusher. The beard is Vuillard's closest friend, but...
He kept his friendship with his best friend.
But he was a scoundrel, this man, and he was cheating on the wife, the sister.
Yeah, and he did that for a very long time. During the 30s, he was still bringing women models, in his atelier and wished the family to go upstairs and leave him alone inside the atelier.
That woman, the sister, should have dumped that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Musée d'Orsay director Guy Courcheval found the evidence of all this in letters and diaries. You see how much fun art experts can have? The owners of that Vuillard with the racy backstory, Marlene and Spencer Hayes of Nashville, Tennessee, have helped to launch American Friends of Orsay to bring American money to the great French museum when national budgets are tight. That will help the Orsay. And did it help get the Hayes collection onto the walls of the Orsay?
What do you think of the overall quality of this collection?
This is an amazing collection.
Again, curator Isabel Kahn.
When Spencer came before the opening of the exhibition, he told me that he was afraid that his collection was not at the same level as the paintings and sculpture in the Musée d'Orsay. But now we know that it is the same level, and it is why it's so beautiful, and we are so happy to have it.
Well, not all visitors may agree. No matter. In Spencer Hayes's view, the pictures he's collected over the years, especially the ones made by the Nabis, are indeed marvelous.
But every night before I go to bed, I spend at least 45 minutes to an hour plus walking around looking at every painting, because that's what's so wonderful about the Nabis. You can always discover something else.
More than 100 works from the Marlene and Spencer Hayes collection are on view at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris until mid-August, which might shorten Spencer Hayes' nighttime prowls for a while anyway. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. When President Obama laid out his ambitious plan to address climate change this week, he focused especially on reducing the amount of carbon dioxide we put into the air. A few pioneering scientists are taking the idea of reducing carbon dioxide in a different direction. They're thinking about ways to remove what's already in the atmosphere and possibly turn a profit in the process. NPR's Richard Harris caught up with one of the scientists who's exploring this new approach.
Lots of researchers are trying to tackle climate change by inventing better batteries, better solar cells, better windmills, and more efficient vehicles. Peter Eisenberger has been looking at the problem from another perspective. He's not trying to invent anything. He's trying to take advantage of the vast wealth of knowledge that we already have at our fingertips.
If you looked at knowledge as a commodity, we had generated this enormous amount of knowledge, and we hadn't even begun to think the many ways they could apply it. So I felt that if we reverse the normal process of innovation, that is, somebody goes in the lab and says, "Eureka, I got this new material, look what it can do, I got this new process," but rather said, "This is what the world needs." You could go and find already existing knowledge that would enable you to do it.
He decided what the world needs is a way to suck carbon dioxide right out of the air. We're putting 30 billion tons of it into the air every year, and it's driving climate change. So he and another professor who works with him at Columbia University founded a company to do just that.
And it turned out that the best device already exists. It's called a monolith. That is the same type of instrument that's in your catalytic converter in your car that cleans up your exhaust.
He put together a bunch of these monoliths. They grab carbon dioxide from the air and release it again when you heat them up. Their company, called Global Thermostat, was bankrolled with seed money from liquor and music magnate Edgar Bronfman. The company has built two pilot plants in Menlo Park, California. But of course, there were big issues to solve. What do you do with the carbon dioxide once you've captured it? And how do you make money?
And so we then looked for these ways to monetize CO2 and found out lots of people wanted to use CO2 as an important feedstock for making a valuable product.
For example, people pipe it into greenhouses, or oil companies pump it underground to help them squeeze out more oil. Soda companies use it to put bubbles in their drinks. But these are mostly small-scale applications, so they'd never require all that much CO2. Maybe someday he could get paid to clean up the atmosphere by sucking out the CO2 and burying it underground, but there's no real support for that now. But using carbon dioxide to make fuel could someday be big. So Eisenberger's first project involves using CO2 to feed algae, which in turn churn out biofuel.
Our first demonstration plant is being erected right now down in Daphne, Alabama, with an algae company called Algae Systems, which sits on Mobile Bay. They'll be floating their algae in plastic bags on the top of the water. We'll be piping in CO2 that we pull out of the air, and the sun will do the rest.
Now, this one project will have zero effect on how much carbon dioxide is in the Earth's atmosphere, but Eisenberger does have much grander ambitions.
I believe we have something that's economically viable, so our company will be successful. But I'm really in this because I want to contribute to the long-term solution that the world needs.
Eisenberger says if he can open the door to capturing carbon dioxide from the air and make the process cheap enough, someday we could actually slow down or possibly even reverse the buildup of carbon dioxide in the air. Robert Sokolow at Princeton University started hearing a buzz about this technology a few years back.
It's catchy. It's attractive conceptually that one could basically pour CO2 into the atmosphere over the next several decades and then take it out later and everything would be fine.
But Sokolow also found that worrisome. So he got his colleagues at the American Physical Society together a couple of years ago to produce a critique of this strategy.
It's seductive, and therefore we better understand its true promise before we get carried away.
It sounds like you were concerned that this would be an excuse for inaction.
Yes.
The physics panel concluded that the technology would be hopelessly expensive, costing $600 for every ton of carbon dioxide it drew out of the air. And the scale would also be huge. Consider what it would take to capture the carbon dioxide wafted into the air from a single coal-fired power plant.
The calculation that we have in our American Physical Society report is that it will be 20 miles long and 30 feet high. So it's like a Great Wall of China.
The committee concluded that it would make a lot more sense to cut down on emissions first, like make our cars, homes, and factories more efficient. They also say it makes much more sense to capture carbon dioxide directly from smokestacks, where it's concentrated, instead of from the air. Sokolow says maybe someday we'll have our emissions under control, and then we might need to remove some of the carbon dioxide that's already in the air with a capture technology. But that's a long way away, in his view.
I locate it in the 22nd century.
In other words, this might be a good project for Eisenberger's great-great-great-grandchildren. No surprise, researchers working on carbon dioxide capture technologies today say that report made it much harder for them to raise money. And Eisenberger says the conclusions are just plain wrong, particularly the panel's cost estimate of $600 a ton.
We have had third-party reports, independent people, evaluating our technology, and it's under $50 a ton.
But Eisenberger says he hasn't actually demonstrated that yet, and he agrees nobody should take his word for it.
I'm just going to do it. And doing it or not, that's the answer.
Eisenberger acknowledges that pursuing a big idea takes some hard-headedness and thick skin.
If they don't tell you you're crazy, you're not doing something worthwhile.
Do you really believe that?
Oh, without a doubt, and history will show you that. Because what you do when you innovate, you disturb the existing order. Fortunately, that's the beauty of science, right? The people that take the time to come into the lab, right, and see it working and can do their own evaluation of the costs and all the performance, they know it's not crazy.
And if he and other researchers pursuing this technology can really make it inexpensive to draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, Eisenberger says it could be a game changer. We could start producing fuels with the carbon dioxide that's already in the air instead of unearthing more fossil fuels. This won't happen quickly, though.
The energy infrastructure of the world is $55 trillion. You know, it's not like a new Google app. The world has made these transitions before, and they just don't happen in a day. But they happen.
There's certainly no guarantee that capturing carbon dioxide from the air will ever become big enough to make a difference to our climate. But it certainly won't if people like Eisenberger don't at least give it a try. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Tomorrow, we'll hear about another scientist who's found a way to make low-carbon diesel fuel from yeast. Baseball, of course, is called America's pastime, and while the ability to pitch a ball is not unique to our country, it turns out that it is unique to our species. A new study in the journal Nature suggests that the ability to throw with speed and precision depends on key features of human anatomy, features that may have given our ancestors the evolutionary edge they needed to spread across the world. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee takes a closer look into the findings of the study by first making a trip to a local baseball diamond.
Pitching is hard work, and it's something that kids at the Home Run Baseball Camp in Washington, D.C. are learning.
Right here, Harry, on the line. Here, let's all do it together. Ready? Follow Coach Mack.
As Coach John McCarthy prepares to pitch, he curls up his left leg and reaches back with his right hand, pulling his shoulder as far back as he can.
Look at my hand!
He swings his arm forward and sends the ball flying. Pitching involves the entire body. But anthropologist Neil Roach of George Washington University wanted to know which parts are most important. So he had 20 athletes throw a ball while he filmed them using a 3D video camera.
And that allowed us to look at how the motion was generated in three dimensions.
He used mathematical modeling to break down that motion into movements of individual body parts. As it turned out, the shoulder played the most important role. Dan Lieberman is an anthropologist at Harvard University and an author on the new study.
As you cock your arm back, you store up huge amounts of elastic energy in the muscles and the other tissues that cross the front of your shoulder.
In other words, our shoulders work like slingshots. When we pull the arm back and behind us, we stretch the ligaments and tendons. When we move the arm forward, the tissues spring back. powering our throws with their elastic energy. The reason our shoulders can do this is because our shoulder blades are placed flat on our backs.
If your shoulder were more vertically oriented, like in a chimpanzee, your muscles can't generate the same amount of power.
Lieberman says the earliest human ancestors also had chimp-like shoulders, but that changed about 2 million years ago. That's when the ancestral species Homo erectus came into the picture.
We widened and broadened our shoulders significantly in the genus Homo.
Now, the authors were only able to study two fossils, so they can't say for certain exactly how human-like these Homo erectus shoulders were. But being able to throw with power and precision, Lieberman says, must have been advantageous to our ancestors. If you consider humans, he says,
we don't have natural weapons. We don't have fangs and claws and massive paws.
So hurling things is about the only thing we can do to bring down our prey. Anthropologist John Shea of Stony Brook University, who wasn't part of the study, agrees. He says previous studies have suggested that Homo erectus was also a good runner.
Now, if you put these two things together, basically you've got the primate equivalent of a fighter jet. You've got something that can run for a long, long time and has projectile weapons on board.
He says the new findings may explain why the species was so successful. They're thought to be the first human ancestor to spread all over the world.
They are the first of these ancestral hominins that's found at the same time in Africa, Europe, and Asia.
No one knows what they were hunting with 2 million years ago, but she thinks they probably used stones, about the size of a baseball. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
And some drugstores are experimenting with ways to keep customers in the store longer. The longer the customer stays, the thinking goes, the more that customer spends. NPR's Brenda Salinas has more.
Lunchtime customers rush in and out of the new Walgreens in Washington, D.C.'s Chinatown district. When they step through the sliding doors, they enter a flurry of activity. They're getting coffee, fresh salads and sandwiches, frozen yogurt and ices. Makeup, and even a midday manicure. This decked-out drugstore is one of 9 so-called flagship locations around the country. The special amenities, they're not just for show.
Flagship stores are really our playground.
Beth Stiller is a Walgreens vice president.
It's where the merchants in our business get to test new trends and innovation and new ideas and new product offerings. So it allows us to get to market quicker in more stores with new product lines.
Stiller says Walgreens places its flagship locations in busy neighborhoods. This helps them generate sales data more quickly. The ideas at work get rolled out to its more than 8,000 stores. But to get customers to try new products and services, you have to urge them to spend more time in the store. Marshall Cohen is a chief retail analyst at NPD, an industry research group. He says Walgreens, the industry leader, is using the same strategy department stores used to rely on.
Now it's really about trying to figure out how do we make it one-stop, multiple shop. In other words, offer the consumer all kinds of reasons to come into the store and ultimately stay in the store longer. And the longer consumers stay in the store, the more apt they are to spend more money.
Stiller says Walgreens has thought a lot about how to keep customers in the store. Every aspect of the DC store, from the amenities to the floor plan, serves this goal. But even so, Stiller acknowledges that tourists and office professionals are in a hurry.
We make that really quick in-and-out experience convenient for them, so we'll have all of that quick grab-and-go, great fresh food right near the door. So if they only have 20 minutes to get in and out for lunch, that's a really quick trip for them into the store.
On the floor devoted to beauty products, there's a big emphasis on natural light. It makes cosmetics look more flattering. Stiller says these details make the shopping experience more enjoyable, and this creates an environment that people want to spend time in and return to. Cohen says a new strategy in the drugstore business is to replicate the convenience of big box stores while mimicking the pleasant shopping experience of a department store.
Retailers are exploring, the big ones are exploring how to do it smaller, and the smaller ones are trying to figure out how to do it bigger. So this is really about everybody trying to find growth and give convenience and services to the consumer to get them to come in, stay in, and spend money.
Cohen says this plan has grown out of the retail industry's recent history. The recession and the popularity of online shopping has meant that brick-and-mortar stores have to give customers a reason to come in. By providing an engaging experience, they can get customers to stay in the store and even add a few extra items to their shopping basket. Brenda Salinas, NPR News, Washington.
Let's go now to Dollar for Dollar. That's our series where NPR's Uri Berliner is trying to figure out what to do with his money, specifically $5,000 in a savings account that's losing value to inflation. He's put some of that cash to work in various investments. Today, Uri dips into the commodities market.
I saw this headline a few weeks ago. It said, cooling coffee prices hit a 3.5-year low. I like coffee. Most people like coffee. That's not going to change. So maybe I could buy coffee low and sell high. Not by hoarding sacks of actual coffee beans, but with a bet on the futures price. I caught up with Jack Scoville at the Price Futures Group in Chicago. He's a futures broker who analyzes the market for agricultural commodities, including coffee. He ticks off reasons why coffee prices have tumbled.
We've had a significant uptick in production. When you look at Colombia, their production's increased, and Brazil has had just a whopper year.
Add in Vietnam, which has quickly become a major grower, and you get the picture. Coffee beans flooding the global market. Consumers around the world, they still like coffee, but many have scaled back their spending. All this helps to explain why the commodity price of green unroasted coffee, also known as the futures price, has fallen to around $1.20 a pound. When I visited, the price was a little higher.
We're up a couple cents, 128.80, the high is 129, the SEP is 130.85, and that's pretty much the high.
That's Scoville on the phone with a coffee grower in El Salvador. Farmers often participate in the futures market. So do big coffee producers. Farmers don't like it when the price is low. Coffee producers don't like it when the price is high. A futures contract offers them a chance to lock in protection from price swings, a hedge. Others are in the market simply as a bet. It's all done through contracts on the futures exchange. A price is set for the delivery of coffee or some other product at a date in the future. Buyers of futures contracts win if the price then goes up. Sellers win if the price later goes down.
If you really want to watch raw economics in action, come into the futures market. That's where it is, even more so than the financial markets, because these are commodities. This is where life starts.
Before my visit to Chicago, I invest $227 in a fund that's linked to the futures price of coffee. When it comes to coffee or other commodities, there are hedgers like farmers and coffee roasters, and then there are others who never touch a coffee bean. They're called speculators.
Well, a speculator is most of the public. Most anybody that would be interested in trading that is not directly involved in using the underlying product itself.
So my small investment makes me a speck of a speculator. Before I leave, I ask Jack Scoville what it would take for coffee prices to come back and make my bet pay off. It could be crop disease, he says, and weather in the southern hemisphere.
Is there a chance we could see a freeze in Brazil? Absolutely. Would that affect their production? Absolutely. Would that affect price? Probably.
Scoville says prices often pick up when roasters buy extra coffee in advance of the winter season. People drink more coffee when it's cold. And over the long term, there's always the world's largest market.
You know, we always look to China. They've become a major consumer. There's a lot of people in China, and they have discovered that coffee tastes good.
Coffee tastes good. That's one of the reasons I decided to make this bet in the first place. So I went to a place where they've been roasting beans and selling coffee for a long time. Gilly's Coffee has been in business in New York since 1840. Donald Schoenholt runs the place. It's been in his family since the early part of the 20th century. And he really knows the coffee business.
Everything in my life is coffee beans, relates to coffee beans. My dad used to take me in with him to help out in the business, so to speak. Come, you'll help me make coffee today. And we would go to the coffee business instead of school.
With coffee roasting machines roaring in the background, Schoenholt brings me to his green coffee room. It has sacks of unroasted coffee from around the world.
And as we walk along, I can point them out to you. These are Colombia Supremos. That's a very big bean coffee from Colombia. Here we have coffee from Peru.
Schoenholt describes himself as a coffee control freak. He can control the quality of the beans he buys, their country of origin, how they're roasted and packaged, but he can't control the price.
Coffee is something that is like a roller coaster in terms of values, and it has always been that way.
In some ways, Schoenholdt operates outside of the futures market. The specialty beans he buys are different from the commodity coffee traded on the exchange. And yet, the futures price still has a big influence on his costs.
It means buying in small quantities of very special things for a very special clientele. And that is the way that we buy.
How do you protect yourself against big price fluctuations?
I do a lot of prayer.
And that's coming from a man who has worked in the business for half a century. My $227 wager on the price of coffee could be in for a bumpy ride. Rory Berliner, NPR News.
You can hear all of the dollar-for-dollar stories and read about Uri's adventures in investing at npr.org.